listening to They Came From the North, the horribly Canadian podcast about filmmakers brought to you by Canadians who are generally contrarian, belligerent, angry, cynical, and did I mention contrarian? Tonight we have a three-pronged assault on the sentence, on the senses, brought to you by the even-handed Steve, who is myself, the rebellious renegade and counterculture deviant, Mr. John Mercer.
Yes, that's totally me.
And the artsy avant-garde savoir-faire, Gabriel Girard.
Pasta.
Pasta?
That's not French. Spaghetti is not French.
Molto bene. Anyway, this was supposed to be a colossal, epic length,
About as long as one of his movies.
Yeah, yeah, multi-tiered attack on the works of James Cameron. But you guys are going to have to wait a little bit longer for us to get, haranguing 15 people across four time zones together to do a podcast on James Cameron is proving to be a little more complex than we thought it would be. So
actually, I do believe one of our American guests had a bit of a family emergency.
I believe so.
Yeah.
I can't remember which one, but I mean, they're Yankees, so.
Yankee, capital imperialist, devil dogs.
Devil dogs.
But by this point, our budget for the James Cameron episode is through the roof.
Yeah, it's proving to be one of the most expensive podcasts in podcasting history.
I like to say that if you turn something in under budget and ahead of schedule, you just ran out of imagination.
That's right. That's right. And we've been having some issues with the crew. They haven't really been getting along with the director. He's proven to be pretty hands-on, and I have the bruises to prove it.
You can't treat people like this. We're people, not animals.
So instead of, getting real deep and complex into the works of probably Hollywood's most accomplished filmmaker of blockbuster films, we'd have decided to go with a smaller, more intimate body of work from a director known for some light, fluffy, casual, easygoing material that's not so difficult to digest and maybe doesn't cause as much conflict in his fan base. Of course, we're talking about who else could we be talking about other than the delightfully cheerful David Fincher.
This century's Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah. who was born in August of 1962. If he were born in 77, it'd be 5 years after I was, or 5 days, sorry, after I was born on August 28th. But he wasn't. He's older than me, jerk. His early career, he did get into initially with special effects, I believe, is where he started. He didn't bother with, film school and all of this kind of stuff. He just took his own little knowledge that he had gathered by watching movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when he was young and, playing with a home video camera, much the same as another accomplished director, Mr. Steven Spielberg. And he just learned things the hard way. He got a job loading cameras and doing other hand, like just dirty work, and was later hired by Industrial Light and Magic, where he worked on Star Wars, Return of the Jedi, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and a ton of commercial work before he wound up with Propaganda Films, who were a marketing firm that was set up in the late 80s, and did feature a lot of the more well-known up-and-comers that came out of the early 90s, actually, guys like Michael Bay, Spike Jonze, Mark Romanek, Michel Gondry, Zack Snyder, Gore Verbinski, Alex Proyas, all of these guys. Propaganda's biggest thing was music videos. And like the rest of the guys, like Michael Bay, Alex Proyas, Fincher did get a bit of a reputation for doing some pretty high-profile music videos in the late 80s, early 90s. He had a video for Madonna, Express Yourself, Vogue, Aerosmith's Janie's Got a Gun, which was a great video. Did a Roy Orbison video, Nine Inch Nails. He's been all over the map. Did a lot of really influential work there before breaking into films with the much maligned Alien sequel, Alien 3.
I can't believe they gave that amount, that type of budget to a 30-year-old.
Mm-hmm. He was pretty hot at the time, and apparently Sigourney Weaver had a lot to do with his involvement in that movie, because by this time she had kind of taken on an executive producer role.
Mm-hmm.
And she was kind of calling the shots, because Fox knew they didn't have a film without her after. The lady was nominated for an Oscar for Aliens, for Best Actress. So she kind of, with Alien.
In a movie that's made up of 85% machine guns.
And their idea of a flirtation scene is talking about assault rifles, But anyway.
Dwayne Hicks is a born romantic.
But anyway, yeah, Sigourney Weaver's newfound clout, basically, she pushed to have someone of, I guess, a visual mind involved, and Fincher must have stood out for some reason or another. But by all accounts, the film was a total nightmare. Production was, beleaguered by Fox executives at every turn. They weren't pleased with the work that Fincher was doing. Fincher wasn't pleased with the fact that he didn't have a finished script when he started filming, and they wouldn't let him lock anything down. It was hell on earth, and by the time it was all done, he had pretty much decided that he was done with filmmaking. Until a few years later, when we got Seven. Now, if Alien 3 was a false start, Seven was the polar opposite. That movie immediately put Fincher's name on the map. At the time, when it was released in 95, that kind of dark, grisly crime thriller just hadn't been seen by the masses. It was not your typical Hollywood film for the 1990s, and it also made real names out of Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman, who were only really just starting to rise at that point. He followed that up with the Michael Douglas thriller The Game, great film. And then in 1999, he was in another, I guess you could call it a production shitstorm with Fight Club, who the Fox execs basically after Seven and The Game kind of gave him a blank check. And when they saw what he was doing with their money, they kind of lost their minds a little bit.
We gave you untold millions, and you chose a Chuck Palahniuk novel.
But it was as much, you had Brad Pitt and Edward Norton, who were both running on a hot streak. Edward Norton off of American History X, and Brad Pitt, well, his star was riding high at the time, So it was kind of a really solid match, and I'd argue at this point it's probably his most well-liked and well-known film.
Yeah.
He followed that up with the relatively unremarkable thriller Panic Room. Then came Zodiac, which is probably his most critically acclaimed film up to that point, a thriller about the Zodiac killings in 1960s San Francisco, or was it San Diego?
San Francisco,
yeah, there we go. Then came another Brad Pitt vehicle, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which was, I would say it was a step outside of Fincher's wheelhouse, but we'll get to that a little later. Then came The Social Network, which really took, the critical world by storm, Oscar nominations, et cetera, et cetera. And the adaptation of the Swedish Millennium novel, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which drew a lot of attention before it was released and kind of faded into obscurity a little bit afterwards, I think. Not necessarily fairly. So with that little intro out of the way, let's get right down to it, and we'll kick it into high gear with our good, bad, and ugly of director David Fincher. We'll start with Mr. Mercer. What is your good?
I had a bit of an agreement with Mr. Forbes as he couldn't make it here tonight. We had both chosen the same movies for our good and bad, and we had discussed, kind of flip-flopping them to get a water discussion on it, basically, right?
Yep.
But seeing as he couldn't make it here tonight, I decided just to go back to my original, which was pretty much a perfect mirror of his. And my good is 1997's The Game. Arguably, this could be called Fincher's most sadistic movie. The Game is essentially the story of a cold, unlikable twat of a man made callous to the world by childhood trauma and the disconnect of his wealth and success from the rest of society, who did better through a series of trials and tribulations. Nicholas Van Orton is in desperate need of a lesson. Only it's not a warm and fuzzy tale like It's a Wonderful Life. The game is absolutely relentless as soon as it starts. And that's probably the reason why, you know, most thrillers like this, they're made of plot holes. You know, they're held together with liquor and duct tape. And but Michael Douglas acts the shit out of Van Orton.
Oh, yeah.
Does he ever?
And he's absolutely fantastic in it. And Fincher just pile drives the eyeballs with his direction. This is probably – how many times have we said assault on the senses tonight? Because that's pretty much what it is. You know, the movie just keeps ratcheting up tension to the point of cardiac arrest. It just – it simply bleeds atmosphere. And despite whatever qualms I might have with the third act, basically, you know, if I were in Michael Douglas' shoes there, I would have murdered everyone in that room.
I'll say straight up, it's my personal – well, I wouldn't pick it as my good, and for reasons we'll get to. But it's my personal favorite of Fincher's movies.
It's just it's the game is a thriller. I just will keep going back to and back to and back to. And, you know, I just discovered tonight that there's a Blu-ray Criterion. So
yeah,
there is, yeah.
Right? I mean, what thrillers don't fall apart in the third act when we start raking a fine-tooth comb over the surface?
See, my whole thing with it is I love that third act.
Mm-hmm.
I love how all the pieces start falling into place.
It's just the – I love it up right until the last couple minutes of it.
And see, I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, to me, like, it's the illustration of Christopher Nolan's theory in The Prestige, you know?
Yeah.
Right? And I was thinking that while I was watching the movie, this could almost be a Nolan flick because it's basically about the movie world in a way.
Yeah. I love, like, the little touches, like, how finely, like, how well figured out these guys had Van Orton, you know, like they had it right down to the hour, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You were invited to between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m. You know, like it was like, wow.
Well, it basically, it's like the story of Job.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this guy who gets the shit.
One of my absolute favorite parts in it, and when I went back to the movie and saw it again, I was like, why the hell didn't I pick up on that first? Is the line. Oh, God, what's the actor's name? James Rebhorn?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Just when he's walking through the office, you know, with the dripping bag of Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it? Tong Hoi, best in Chinatown?
Mm-hmm.
And just, it, there's a reveal later on in the movie uses that line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, that's fucking genius.
I love when he's up on the rooftop and, you know, Kara Unger's there and he's flipping out, and she's like, "He's up here," and like, it's just a line that's totally throwaway in the background that she's yelling into the walkie-talkie or whatever. And like, if you're not really paying attention, you'd probably even miss it. You know, it's probably not even something you'd pick up on. But she's like, "He's up here, and he's got a real gun." You know?
Yeah,
like that stuff is wicked.
It's a lot like the there's a line similar to that in The Usual Suspects.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's kind of just put. I honestly think it was they said let's do it because no one's going to pick up on it.
Yeah,
because I'm going to have everybody in that theater with their hand gripped to their fucking chest.
Yeah,
right, sweat pouring down from their hairline. They're not going to be. They're not going to pick up on that.
No.
And in a way, like I find Fincher, you know, he's a director that loves to explore ideas. There's always like a philosophical thing, you know, behind his movies.
He's in one respect, he's a lot like Ridley there. He's an idea man. Everything springs from an idea.
And that's one of the great things about the game, because in one way it's like this, like, all cylinders rolling thriller, but at the same time you can view it as a certain, like, existentialist movie, you know?
Yep.
Like, life is absurd, and you know, this guy has to go deep down in the shit to real life, like that what he's having is nothing, that he doesn't have a real life and all that stuff.
Yeah. And it's one of those, like, you know, I put it up there with two or three other movies, you know, with Romancing the Stone, Black Rain, Wonder Boys. And I know that those three movies don't really go together, but it's a great Michael Douglas performance.
What's the Joel Schumacher flick too?
Oh, Falling Down, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, like, it's proof that Michael Douglas doesn't just do these sleazy doctor or lawyer types, you know? Like, he is
fantastic actor.
Yeah, he's a nuanced actor, man. You know,
Michael Douglas is not the son of Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas is Michael Douglas' dad.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, I honestly, there are times, I mean, I shouldn't feel bad doing because he's married to one of those beautiful women in the world and, you know, is, like, ludicrously rich from being, you know, a movie star and a producer and everything.
Yep.
But I've always felt terrible that the guy has, I don't even know, like, where the rep comes from.
No, because, and, like, it blows my mind, too, because you get these directors who've worked with him, like Robert Zemeckis, Ridley Scott, David Fincher, and, like, nobody really has a bad word to say about the guy. You know, like, nobody says he's a bad guy or he's an asshole or whatever, no. And yet he's got this reputation as being a dick.
I think it's the basic instinct. Because
everyone else is jealous that he married Zorro's wife.
Well, I mean, I would totally be marrying Zorro's wife. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're as old as her father, Michael. Who gives a shit?
Look at her. Have you seen her?
I think it's identifying the actor with a lot of the parts that he plays.
Everyone thinks he's Gordon Gekko.
Yeah.
Or like same thing with Jack Nicholson. We know he's crazy, but he's probably not that crazy, you know.
Oh, Jack.
No, I think Jack is more of a warm and fuzzy crazy, right?
I think Jack is that crazy old uncle that you have at family get-togethers. You know, that everybody just kind of rolls their eyes at.
I think, yeah, no, Jack Nicholson in real life is probably, like, what everyone wants Bill Murray to be like. Only, you know, you turn the camera on, and suddenly, you know, he turns into,
Jack Torrance.
Yeah. But,
with every role.
Yeah, The Game is just phenomenal movie, and I don't want to go too deep into that final act because there's so much good stuff there and so many little
And honestly, it's one of Fincher's forgotten movies. Yeah. I don't want to spoil too much because it's just, you know, everybody should see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's absolutely phenomenal.
And another thing, he doesn't have a huge role in it, but man, his presence is felt. Sean Penn.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that scene at the beginning in the restaurant where he, you know, gives him the card or whatever and says, you know, whereas once I was blind, now I can see. You know, like what his role in that movie has resonance, you know?
Well, every tiny little role has their effect.
I want to make it stop.
Yeah. And we have to give props to our compatriot, Deborah Unger.
Mm-hmm. Who is awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, I forgave her for Crash.
Yeah, between Payback and The Game, she has definitely earned my good graces.
Hey, don't forget Highlander 4 or whatever.
Oh, Highlander. Highlander 3. She was in Highlander 3.
It's Highlander 3.
Which was the only other watchable Highlander movie. All right. Who wants to go next? Me or Gabe?
I'll go next.
Okay.
I'll go with what I personally consider to be his masterpiece, a movie that it will probably never, you know, equal, and that is just amazing on every level, and that is Zodiac.
Zodiac's another amazing flick, yeah.
I mean, all the stuff that's explored in the movie, the feeling of unease that he creates, and just the way that it's not another standard, like, crazy killer flick, that it's more about this detective and his friends, and, you know, everything works in that movie. There's some great dialogue, some great humor, some great sense of tension. I can't think of a bad thing to say about it. I think it's pretty much perfect. It feels both, like he tries to recapture that feel, but it feels very like a 70s, like William Friedkin or something, you know?
Yeah. It feels like a procedural, you know?
But a really, really good one.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. And it really nails the time. Like it really nails that era in a way that, you know, movies generally don't. Like the late 60s were always kind of this, you know, bright, sunny hippies and, you know, Vietnam and yada, yada. Like, it's always, you know, rock music and bright colors, mm-hmm. and, you know, whereas Zodiac is a damn oppressive, dark-looking movie, man. You know?
And let's not forget, movie watchers, Mark Ruffalo owns your ass as Dave Tosche.
He is awesome in the movie. And that leads me to...
This is the... it's kind of weird because the character, or Dave Tosche, was the real-life inspiration for Dirty Harry.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he couldn't be any more different.
Yeah. Yeah, Ruffalo was amazing in it, and Robert Downey Jr. was amazing in it. But I gotta say, I wasn't huge on Gyllenhaal.
Oh, I thought he was really good.
And it wasn't so much him as the character. And I mean, I don't know how much of it was taken from real life versus how much of it was fabricated for the screenplay for heightened drama. But it is the typical, like the stereotypical, you know, the descent. You know, becomes obsessed. His wife leaves, takes the kids, and you know, like it was almost too.
And it's not, he's got a wife and kids, but Jake Gyllenhaal is obviously 14 years old.
Yeah. but that thing still, like, it creates that whole link with the obsession of the murderer himself, and, like, it creates that gray zone that Fincher likes so much.
Yeah.
What really surprised me about it is when I first saw, I think the first thing they released of it was the poster, right?
Yeah.
Great shot of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I turned to my wife and I said, okay, probably the most notorious unsolved serial killer in history.
Yep.
From the director of Seven.
Yeah.
This is going to be awesome. And it's not that movie.
No. But it is still pretty awesome.
It's something better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, you stop there. Take a look at the cast for a second, okay? All right? Let's just take a look at some of the bit players. All right, you got Elias Koteas.
Yeah.
Brian Cox.
Yep.
Let's see. There was somebody else really good in
Dermot
this.
Dermot Mulroney.
Charles Fleischer.
John Carroll Lynch is Arthur Lee Allen.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
And Charles Fleischer, too, is amazing.
Yeah. It's so creepy. Yeah, and it's the biggest, like, the downside for me with Zodiac, the one thing that bugs me, and I almost hate to say it. I almost hate to bring it up because it's not that kind of a movie. It's Fincher in that it's not a typical, you know, it doesn't follow the norms, the Hollywood norms or whatever, the conveniences. But to me, it feels like it doesn't really have a final act.
Well, it can't have because the story doesn't have one.
Exactly. And it's not really any fault of the movie or something, but it always kind of bugged me. Like it starts really, really strong. And then it just kind of spins its wheels, and then it's over. But I hesitate to say that as a negative because I love the film. I mean, I really love Zodiac, but
I have a feeling that's a Fincher thing too. Like he likes to leave the viewer kind of unsatisfied at the end of the movie.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and maybe
like,
that's.
But what did you expect Dave Tosche and the Zodiac Killer to have a karate fight?
No, right? It's not even that. It's not even a matter of, you know, like closure with the case or whatever, but even the characters just kind of seem to be left hanging. And then, like, how it kind of jumps ahead in time at the end, too, you know? Like, I think there could have been a better way to clue it up earlier, I think. Like, I think he could have done something to put a point on it before it jumped ahead to, what, the 1980s and then 1991 or whatever it was, you know? Like...
And another thing that I found like links it to the not only recapturing like the sense of time, but also like the filmmaking of the time. You know the way that he shot it.
Yeah,
it's very like it could be like an Alan Pakula film or a Cine Lumet. You know.
Yeah, it definitely felt like a Lumet film. And the other thing I'll say for it is those kill scenes early on are shocking as hell.
Oh, and like we were talking about earlier about opening scenes or opening credits, that first slow shot of the car, you know?
Yeah.
Like in slow motion, just dreadful.
Really well put together movie. I mean, like, I hate to bring up the thing about the final act or not having a final act or whatever, but it was just something the last time I watched it bugged the shit out of me. And I don't know why it was. It just... I don't know,
but it is a great
movie. It's not a good movie. It's a great movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, it's just there's something about that final act, boy, that just kind of leaves me a little cold, I guess.
I was trying to think, and I'm like, there does not been that many.
It's like you in the movie are getting hot and heavy, and then it rolls over and says it has a headache.
No, I just, I mean, there had to have been a way to put more of a point on it. Like, I mean, yeah, okay, it might have left things a little more open, but there had to have been a way to put a point on it without moving ahead in time and stuff, you know?
Yeah. But still, I mean, finishing with the credits with the hurdy-gurdy man playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, oh shit, I lost my point. Just like Grace Smith lost in the Meanders.
Yeah.
It'll come back to him halfway through
the movie. I was gonna say that, like, I was trying to think of a crime movie that's been this good in the last few years, and there hasn't, you know?
Well, I guess it depends, too, on your definition of crime movie. Are you thinking, like, crime thriller, like true crime thriller, or are you thinking more like cop thriller kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah, of course, but...
Don't make me smack you with a copy of American Gangster, Gabe.
Or The Town, or Heat.
Yeah, you're right, but like that type of crime movie.
Yeah, the more true crime kind of thing.
Did you say Heat, Steve?
Well, no, Heat's before, I know.
Heat is nearly 20 years old.
Yeah, shut up.
But like I was telling one of my friends, I mean, I have no, like, nothing against putting it against something like Chinatown. To me, it's that great, you know?
I agree. I think I prefer it to Chinatown, even though Chinatown does have a denouement, you know? But I think I prefer Zodiac to Chinatown.
But yeah, Zodiac is awesome.
Great movie.
There you go.
I would have picked it as my good, actually. I was very close. I was back and forth between that and The Game. But ultimately, I had to give it the 7.
Nice.
When it came out, I remember seeing 7 opening weekend. It was this thing. I worked at the Evening Telegram at the time. And every Saturday night, it was myself and a girl from work and two other people would get together. And we'd go see whatever new movie was out that week, whatever big movie that had to write up in the paper the night before, you know. And there was this big write-up about 7. And I'm sorry, guys, spoiler, statute of limitations is in effect. But the write-up was talking all about how the bad guy wins. And how unheard of this was in a mainstream Hollywood movie. And that ending, man, blew my mind when I saw it. The first time I saw it, that ending totally blew my mind. It was just how it all comes together at the end was so incredible. But beyond that, the whole movie as a collective whole, like from start to finish, it captured that uneasy, just that real dark side of human nature. You know, there's your blurb for the back of the movie case, right? But Fincher just captured that darkness so well in that movie. You know, everything was just so oppressive, so dark, so foreboding, you know.
And talk about production design.
Oh, man. Oh, and I mean, like, it wasn't a huge budget film. It wasn't this big blockbuster movie, you know. This was a late summer release, I think. And it was just, you know, it was...
Just since the school year started, actually. It was in September.
Yes, and it was kind of like, it was a Brad Pitt vehicle is what it was. You know, Brad Pitt was just starting to get a name for himself as something more than a pretty boy. And, like, it was just kind of it was really the beginning of his career. And the beginning of Morgan Freeman as a known actor, as a known quantity, you know?
And I was trying to think about that. Was Spacey known before this? Not really.
No, no. No, this was I think it comes after it came after The Usual Suspects, I believe. But
that came out like it got momentum later.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It around award season, right? When the screenplay was nominated and all of that kind of stuff. But yeah, and Spacey, like, I mean, just
no, I mean, but before that, Kevin Spacey was the friggin' weaselly little shit from Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. That's true. That's true. So it was a bit of a different turn for him.
Yeah.
But like, he wasn't really known in the main street, and to see the killer come out of nowhere and you just give himself up, and you're like, who the heck is this guy?
Yeah,
you know.
So
why does he look like I'd picture the devil?
Yeah, so many just creepy moments, like, and tension. Man, tension is unbelievable in this movie. the scene where the guys finally find the apartment, you know, and you see the guy at the end of the hall walking up with the shopping bags, and then there's that sudden gunshot, and it's just like, whoa! You know, like, so much little stuff like that, that really kind of got me. And then when they first get in there and start going through the books and stuff, and, you know, and the apartment with the guy, Sloth, I won't say any more than that, but that was just, man, oh man.
All of them are just fiendishly designed.
Fiendish and unsettling as all hell. I mean, as unsettling as the girl with the dragon tattoo is, I don't think there's really anything that will top Lust from Seven.
No.
That was brutal, you know? And, like, just the poor guy in the interrogation room and stuff, too.
Oh, and he never stopped. No, and even at the crime scene, while they're looking at stuff, you can still hear him screaming in the background.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's absolute madness. The movie is madness. It really is. And just...
Oh, and the sloth scene, getting back, I pooped myself. I was 13 years old and I was embarrassed, but I pooped myself.
And like when he's in the hospital and it's the doctor they're talking to, which is I think the same doctor from the beginning of Fight Club, says, you know, quite frankly, if you shone a flashlight in his eyes, he'd die of shock right now. You know, yeah. It's like, but it's just such a textured, dark, fiendishly oppressive movie, man. And and yet it's also an enjoying movie to watch. Like the performance is like Freeman's performance is amazing. Pitt does a great job. Gwyneth Paltrow does a great job. And just the way it all unfolds, like, you know, that when the guys are in the car with Spacey and he's given his now infamous monologue about, you know, what I've done here today will be talked about and et cetera, you know, like it's just so many brilliant filmmaking moments. It really is, you know, a movie that inspired, I'd say at least a decade worth of imitators, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I have always loved the final line from the movie.
Yeah.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
Yeah.
I agree with the second part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just, it was so different for its time, you know? There really hadn't been anything like it before it.
Well, what's really funny is at the same, roughly around the same time in theater, there was another serial killer movie came out called Copycat.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Copycat.
I remember.
And Copycat got completely overlooked, and it's just that type of thriller for the longest while. And I mean, I enjoy that type of disposable thriller.
Yeah,
right?
Copycat was pretty good, if I remember well.
Copycat was like, you know, hey, Silence of the Lambs was pretty popular, so let's have another chick hunt down a serial killer.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I know, but I've always dug stuff, you know, like Jagged Edge or Shattered or,
Pulp
right?
Collector. And
yeah,
that stuff. It's
that Diane Lane one with the guy who was broadcasting the deaths on the internet or something.
Untraceable.
Untraceable.
Yeah, I still love that for the way they killed Forrest Gump's kid.
That was a pretty good flick too, though.
Yeah, but no, I love those types of movies. Seven opened up and put a stake in their heart.
Yeah, it did.
Right? For like, it took like 10 years for anyone to even dare to try to make a thriller that wasn't like Seven.
Yeah.
Another thing that I like about it is that it does keep certain conventions, like, you know, the rookie cop and the older cop, but it uses them to make something different, you know?
Yeah.
To that relationship actually means something. It's not just rote.
It's like using old ingredients to make a new stew, you know?
Yeah.
It was just such a different movie. And, it still holds up extremely well.
Oh, know? Yeah.
And I think this was actually, Seven was the movie where everyone, you know, really took notice of Brad Pitt.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was. It was, you know,
here's this Hollywood's pretty boy, but, you know, he's actually keeping up with Morgan Freeman and Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I mean, I love that exchange where, you know, he's a fucking freak show. He's a movie of the week. He's a fucking T-shirt at best. You know, like that scene is
it's actually, you're a fucking freak show.
Yeah.
He's actually saying it to Spacey.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I got to ask you a question. Do you ever, like, when you're sitting down with Guns and Ammo magazine masturbating in your own feces, has it ever dawned on you, wow, I really am fucking crazy? I probably didn't do it. Beth can do that perfectly. She knows that entire scene off by heart.
Yeah, and Spacey's monologue there, man. Like, I mean, like I said earlier, that's just... I remember when it premiered on the Movie Network, when they first started showing Seven on the Movie Network, all it was the shots of the city, you know, which was Chicago, but in Seven, I think it's meant to be just a nondescript city, you know.
I thought it was Seattle, probably because it never stops raining.
No, I think they just call it the city.
They never mentioned one.
Yeah, but all it is the overhead shots of the city with Kevin Spacey's monologue spoken over him. And then it's just, you know, 7 this month on the Movie Network. And that was like, that was effective as hell. You know?
Yeah.
I also think this was the movie that really, I'm going to be a geek now for a few minutes.
Yeah.
The opening credits.
Yeah.
That was Kyle.
Imaginary Forces, yeah.
Yeah, no, but it was actually like the guy from the Metal Gear games and Black Hawk Down. And, yeah. I think this is what launched him as well.
Definitely, definitely. Well, I mean, you know, there was a big thing on the DVD release when it got the new line, their Prestige series, when they did the 2-disc and Fincher went in and recolored it all and did a lot of heavy work on it. But there was a really nice documentary about Kyle Cooper making the opening sequence and stuff on it.
Yeah, I think they actually wrote all those things.
Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, and I think the shots of him stitching the phone books, or stitching the exercise books together and stuff, that was actually Kyle Cooper with band-aids wrapped around his fingers and stuff, you know, like.
It was, actually. Yeah, no, they had an article about that on Cracked a little while ago, too.
Yeah, it was.
About the amount of detail put into the stuff that you don't even notice on screen.
Yeah. And I mean, like, that movie was just, that was one hell of a well-crafted thriller. And again, I mean, you know, like, it was a Brad Pitt vehicle at the time and stuff, but it wasn't a huge budget. You know,
$30 million, and it brought in close to $400 million.
Yeah, like $30 million in 1995 money, which is not like that. That's average at best, you know. Yeah.
And in a way, I think, you know, to bring someone up to Fincher who doesn't know, M7 might be the perfect entry point, you know, because it's got everything that makes Fincher Fincher.
Yeah, and it is an accessible film, you know, despite being grisly as shit. It's actually somewhat accessible.
And when you were talking about the city and stuff, it made me think that Fincher has this thing about shooting buildings and about shooting towns that make them seem so scary. You know, nobody does that like him.
Well, I've never been there myself, but I'm told Chicago is actually scary as all fuck.
Well, but you get that in all of his movies, like in Dragon Tattoo and in Panic Room and...
I dare him to take on St. John's.
Oh, I'm sure it could make Montreal look pretty nasty.
Yeah. A lot of big old brick buildings in Montreal.
With a hobo.
Then he'd shoot Montreal and convince everyone it was Istanbul.
Yeah. Have some hobo walk up to Brad Pitt. Come on, Sava. With that, I guess that's it for goods. Anybody got anything left to say about 7 or Zodiac or the game?
Well,
watch all of them right now.
Yeah,
go to the video store.
I would
depress
say
the shit out of yourself.
We've talked about it a bit, but we could easily have chosen Dragon Tattoo too.
Yeah, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Yes, I mean, it has to be said, and I mean, this, we're breaking with formula a little bit here right now, but all three of us agree that it is one damn fine and effective piece of filmmaking, and it really kind of defies this whole pop culture based on a novel legacy that it has. It's a great flick that's really well worth watching. Fincher just directs the shit out of it.
Talk about tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the most intense movie. You know, like, just grip it of your seat, like, what is going to happen?
Yep, and disturbing as hell.
Yeah.
You know what else I'm really happy about? I think Daniel Craig is the first James Bond to have a non-James Bond movie become a hit.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
And you know what? He was absolutely fantastic in it, too.
Oh, yeah, he's good.
I mean, I know Craig's a good actor anyway. I mean, I'd seen Craig before James Bond, so I know I know what he's capable of, you know? But he's Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, all three of us. That's we'll call that our token good, because all three of us agree that it's fucking awesome.
Okay, well, let's just consider this for a second. I got to bring up the four horsemen in this movie.
Okay.
Okay, you got Christopher Plummer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Stellan Skarsgård.
Oh, yeah.
I can't pronounce the guy's last name, but he's the dude from ER, Goran
Vincek?
Yeah. He's in it. And then fucking Christopher Plummer, Canadian royalty, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, you want evil up on screen? And Plummer even plays a likable person.
Oh, yeah.
He's actually a likable cat in this movie. Even he's kind of dark. You're just waiting for him to say that he molested farm animals or something the entire time. Everybody in this movie is a bad person.
And Craig's reaction would be the same as everything else in the movie. Put a cigarette in his mouth.
I will say the worst scene for me, the worst scene by far, was the poor cat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. I was like, you bastards! How dare you! I hope Daniel Craig finds you and fucks up your shit.
He has a gun that shoots elbows. It's his elbow.
Anyway, moving on to the bad. You all know the rules. There aren't any. But no, seriously, it's not necessarily a bad film. Not something that's necessarily horrible or crap or, you know, particularly poorly executed. But just something that we may like or dislike based on certain flaws that just don't appeal to us as individuals. You know, so like it could be something that's critically acclaimed, but we just don't like for whatever reason. Or vice versa. It could be something critically panned that we kind of enjoy for whatever reason because we're crazy, you know. But I'll mix it up a little bit this time. I'll start with you, Gabe. What have you got for your bad?
I have Panic Room. Panic Room is the most like serviceable, like McDonald's fabricated thriller that Fincher has made. You know, it's really good. I mean, it's really well made and it works well, but it just feels so
rote,
yeah, and empty. I mean, there are some ideas that I think he's trying to do in there, like with class warfare and, you know, like good and evil and all that stuff. But I mean,
Dwight Yoakam obviously being a sex offender.
Mm-hmm. All I could think of is, why the hell is there a country singer in this movie?
Yeah, but you can't tell me he was like perfect slime ball.
Oh, he was. He totally was.
But it
you feel the grease running out of his hair.
Like most of Fincher movies, will leave an impression on you, and Panic Room is one of these movies that you see, you enjoy, and you kind of forget.
Yeah, I could go along with that. I'll also say that, you know, it's, if you know someone were to take an R-rated suspense thriller and engineer it as a McDonald's Happy Meal, it would be Panic Room.
Macaulay Culkin was awesome in it.
Yeah, I like the long hair look on Macaulay Culkin.
It's like, wow, Kristen Stewart never smiled. That's our first big movie, was a David Fincher movie.
You know, you understand why they selected her to play Joan Jett now.
Yeah, really.
And actually, I will give it one thing. Normally, I hate Forrest Whitaker a lot.
My phone's ringing. Sorry, guys. Keep going.
Normally, I hate Forrest Whitaker, but I actually kind of dug him in Panic Room.
I thought he was pretty good. I thought he was
I loved his character's ending to it.
Yeah.
You know, he could have got away clean, but he went back to do the right thing.
Yeah. And
now he gets to spend 20 years in prison.
Yeah, after getting shot. Didn't he get shot? Yeah.
Yeah, he got shot, but I can't remember if he got shot or not.
And then I have to bring in the diabetes thing, which was fucking stupid.
Yeah.
Just to put a bomb timer in there, right?
Yeah, plot device.
I mean, they could have had a different plot device. They could have just had, you know, Jodie Foster was going to beat her daughter to death if they didn't get her on.
Man, you try spending 3 hours locked in a room with Kristen Stewart, okay, and see what happens. I think you want to beat her to death, too.
Vampires, Kristen. No, 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 no. You want to be interested in other women.
Have you ever seen The Beaver?
Oh, no.
Jodie Foster has.
Oh, my God.
It's okay. You can clean that whole up in post.
Post?
What's post?
I'm going to get an email now tomorrow from Staley. You're fired.
You totally are.
I don't know, after the comments about the captain being mongoloid or something. We're good.
I already told you guys, though, as some of you had that in my family, it's cool for me to make fun of it.
Okay. If you say so.
I'm a horrible, horrible person.
All right. Why is it always you?
Let's move on, because I'm always so neat and polite and friendly.
Let's move on. What's your bad dog?
My bad would be Fight Club. Oh, my contrarian. Controversy! Let's give the peanut gallery a second to quiet down. Fight Club's a divisive topic with me, and my opinion of the movie depends entirely on how I'm feeling on any given day. You know, on the one hand, Fincher shoots the hell out of it. It's a greasy, slick bit of filmmaking. Never anything less than visually stunning. It's awesomely acted. Brad Pitt's the bomb in it.
So is Norton. You know, come on now, give
Norton
credit.
Norton's fantastic.
Well, and then Carter looks amazing with a cigarette.
That's, yeah, you never, ever wash your hair.
You just like Tim Burton.
That's why they get along so well. What kind of conditioner do you use? None.
I wash my hair with dirt.
Just like the Metallica Until It Sleeps video.
Yeah, pretty much.
But you know, the first dozen times I saw Fight Club, I devoured it. I studied it. I made sweet and sensual love to it with oils and everything. The trouble is, I was 17.
Yeah, then you grew up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, its intellectual message hits about as subtly as a jackhammer. But that's par for the course with Chuck Palahniuk. Dobbin's going to hate me for that.
I don't think Dobbin's a huge fan, actually.
Oh, good.
Oh, maybe he is. I'm not sure.
No, because I remember him telling me Choke sucked.
I don't know.
But, you know, my deal with Fight Club, I liken it to my relationship with punk music. There are days when I will rock right the fuck out to Social Distortion or the Cramps or Good Riddance or Minor Threat. And then there's days when I put on my khakis, drink my coffee, and go to work like a grown-up. It's Fight Club's like Scarface or Pulp Fiction. You know, there's posters found on the walls of university students everywhere telling us the rules of Fight Club.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like the thing that the people don't get is at the same time that it's saying those ideas that appeal to the young, it's like destroying them, right? Yeah, it's destroying them because it's showing out, it leads to like totalitarianism, kind of, you know.
Yeah, and Fight Club's be like a big cult phenomenon, a big enough cult phenomenon to make top 10 movie lists of fist pumping bros worldwide. You know, it's certainly a flashy movie, and it's a damn fine example of how to adapt a novel to the big screen.
Oh, it was way better than the book. That had to be said.
The big reveal in it, and like, is handled fantastically.
Mm-hmm. The whole final act is great.
Yeah, and but Fight Club is nothing more than brash Friday night entertainment. It's well acted, it's well shot, it's loud, it's covered in tattoos, and more than likely it's on its way to a cage fight. But don't try to tell me it's anything more substantial than that.
I
don't know.
I like Fight Club. I really do, but maybe it's just me being silky now because I've had so many years of people telling me it's brilliant.
Yeah, and that could be a lot of it. And I mean, yeah. My whole thing, I'll be the first to admit, the first time I saw Fight Club, it was in 2000. It was shortly after myself and Sarah had first gotten together. We went out and rented it, I think, on VHS. Or no, I think we bought it on VHS. I think I just went out and bought it blind.
See, sick-ass X-Men trailer.
Yeah, and I remember sitting down and watching it, and when it was over, we were both like, man, that was freaking awesome. And then the next day, I think we might have watched it four or five times during that week because we showed it to a few of the guys and whatnot. And then when it was released on DVD, which came later, like it was late to DVD for some reason or another, it got this really, really nice two-disc collector set on DVD that I picked up right away. And then we just rediscovered it again. We sat down and started watching it again. And you know, when I was 20 or 21 years old, or 22, however old I was, 20, 22, something like it was early 20s, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Because, I mean, you know, it's And this
it's
is
Metalhead the movie.
And, but what it is Fincher was brilliant in how he put it together.
Like, yeah, it is a brilliant movie.
He really was brilliant in how he put it together, because what he does is he appeals to that, you know, that 22-year-old male sensibility of, you know, I'm 22, I'm just out of college or university, I have to start looking for a real job. And he's basically sitting there telling you exactly what you want to hear. Fuck that, don't get a real job. What are you, crazy? Don't be one of the monkeys, man. Don't capitulate, you know? And yeah, you're sitting there going, fuck yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Fincher. Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking right now, because I can't stand the thought of getting a job. I'm, you know, whatever. But then when you get older, you know, you get into your 30s, and you sit down and you watch it again, and it takes on a whole new meaning. It's like, holy shit, he's kicking the piss out of university students is what he's doing. You know, like he's actually skewering it, and you're like, you get older and you look at it and you're like, my God, how could I have ever believed in something so completely absurd and over the top?
And you know, there's a part of it too that I feel that, you know, he's saying that, you know, there's a good message in there, you know, that, you know, there, it's something to reflect upon, but once you organize, you start to organize it around a cult.
Yeah, then it goes bad.
Then it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, you, like I was saying in discussions before, you think about The Social Network, like I was trying to think of how it fits into his work. And I'm like, basically, The Social Network is a movie about the people that Tyler Durden hates, you know?
And I think, like, just plot-wise and stuff, like, the way it's written, the dialogue and stuff, there's not one leaden line of dialogue in that movie. Like, every single sentence uttered in that movie crackles, you know?
Well, dude, I got in so much trouble when we were writing down names for Jacob.
Yeah,
because I put down Robert Paulson on the list. And Elizabeth's like, why do you have Robert Paulson down there? I said, because in death, a member of Project Mayhem gains a name. And his name is Robert Paulson. It's just, yeah, it's instantly quotable.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, it's visually, like, again, from a design standpoint, Fincher's the fucking man.
He is. He really is. Yeah.
And once again, I have to bring up Edward Norton. Like, those scenes where you see him beating on himself, those are crazy.
And it's just like the way
it looks. And again, the bit parts in it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You know, Jared Leto. I've wanted to beat up Jared Leto for years.
But it's just, when I first saw it, I thought that was Jake Busey because of the blonde hair.
And then Meatloaf. I like to picture that when Meatloaf was filming his fight scenes, he was imagining it was all the people who said he was a poser. Because, I mean, Loaf's on guys like a fucking gorilla.
Mm-hmm. I still enjoy Fight Club. I don't love it like I did, but I still really enjoy that movie. And,
well, Fight Club used to be something that was a contender to win our DVD lotto game every time, right?
Yeah.
It was always a serious contender.
Yeah.
And now I think it's more like something, you know, a year from now or whatever, someone will pull Fight Club, and I'll be like, hey, Fight Club.
Yeah, it was. And, I mean, the last time we watched it was when Dobbin picked it up on Blu-ray.
Blu-ray,
and,
yeah.
I mean, I had a lot of fun going back to it then because it had been the first time in a while. And the last time I had watched it was maybe about 5 or 6 years ago. And it left me feeling kind of cold, you know, like I was kind of like at the end, I was kind of like, yeah, that's nowhere near as good as I remember it being, you know, like that kind of feeling.
That's my whole thing with Fight Club. That's why it's my bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a great movie. It's a good movie, but it can't stand toe to toe with stuff like The Game or Zodiac.
No, and that's true. It can't. And basically
it definitely can't even shine the shoes of Seven.
No. And I think what we're basically saying is we're all after getting old and contrarian, so it depends on what kind of movie.
once again, that ending line is just perfect.
Yeah.
You have met me at a very strange time in my life. Yeah. Oh, shit.
And I really wish that the epilogue had been put in there. The epilogue from the novel. I don't know if either of you guys have read the novel.
No.
I read it years ago. Is it yours or Sarah's?
Sarah's,
yeah. It was years ago. She loaned me her copy.
I gave it to her for her birthday the second year we were together, I think. And basically the whole epilogue at the end of it is Tyler, of course, narrating, because the whole novel is his narration. And talking about being in heaven after shooting himself, you know, and how heaven is all a lot of really bright white lights and, you know, they give you pills and once a month I go and I meet with God and God sits behind a big wooden desk and he's got all kinds of pieces of paper on his wall with lots of signatures on them, you know, and like...
That sounds more like a Terry Gilliam flick.
But I think if that epilogue had been put in there, like maybe after a little credits break, I think it would have been absolutely fantastic.
And that's who they should get to direct another one of Palahniuk's books.
Terry Gilliam.
Oh, poor Gilliam. We'll get to him someday.
Someday. So, my bad. I'm going with Fincher's first film here. I'm going with Alien 3. So much good stuff in that.
Oh, yeah.
So much great stuff in that movie.
Nowhere near the hate it gets.
No.
Nowhere near
no.
the hate it gets.
See, there is a reason Alien 3 gets so much hate.
Because it wasn't Aliens?
Exactly. It wasn't the sequel to Aliens. There's no Michael Biehn. There's no Newt. You don't get you don't get that emotional payoff from Aliens. You know, like, you get so attached to those characters and Aliens that you want them to live happily ever after. And Alien 3 is, you know, Alien 3 is like a big bucket of cold water.
You know? Can I just say something here, Steve?
Yep.
The Weyland-Yutani Corporation are building better worlds, and Newton, Ripley, and Hicks, and half of Bishop have no place in those worlds.
No, no. But I just, you know, so much of that movie to me, like, it still feels like an Alien sequel, unlike Alien Resurrection, you know? It really still had that DNA from that first movie. You could tell that Fincher really, you know, his heart and soul was in it. He wanted to make a good Alien film, you know?
And you get like you're watching a director who, you know, his first movie, and this is a dream come true.
Yeah.
Because I'll bet you Fincher loved the shit out of Alien.
Oh,
sure. You know he did. You know he did. And on top of that, even beyond that, like, it's accomplished, man.
Oh, yeah.
This is not the work of a first-time director.
Oh, no.
You know?
I mean, all those, like, those scenes were in near the end where they're, like, coordinating and trying to smoke it out.
Yeah, like...
The flamethrowers, that's...
And all the parts when the camera is the camera's chasing them, and it's supposed to be from the POV of the alien, right?
Mm. Yep. Really well put together, man.
I call them the Sam Raimi shots, only it's a million times better than anything Raimi could have pulled off. But, I mean, man, yeah, like... My heart was up in my throat every time one of them would start running.
Yep.
Because, like, they can't outrun that thing.
Yeah, and this is the other area where it really succeeds. I actually consider it to be the most intense movie of the classic trilogy of Alien, Aliens, and Alien 3. You know, like, it is right from the opening, man. It's just something about the way he shoots that opening sequence where you got the rushing flames and the little, like, you know, the cold British computer voice with her fire in cryogenic compartment and like just the way it's shot. Even that opening sequence is creepy, you know?
Well, it's all about that feeling of the hopelessness, you know?
Yeah. And just dread. Like, the whole movie is laced with dread, you know? I think it's an effect.
Is it existential dread?
No, not even existential dread, just dread. Just straight up terror.
I can't remember because it's been a while since I've seen the original cut, but I think there's a lot of more like interesting discussions that's put back in the assembly cut. You know?
Yeah. Oh, and the assembly cut is the one to watch. The assembly cut.
Well,
you know, you get into the whole religious aspect.
I had that on about a week and a half ago.
Yep.
When because I just picked up the Alien, what do they call the Blu-ray box?
The anthology, Alien Anthology.
Yeah, Alien Anthology?
Yeah.
So they finally got rid of that stupid quadrilogy word.
well, because now they're including Prometheus, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, I hadn't noticed it because I wasn't familiar with the actor the first time I'd seen it. Fucking Charles Dance was Clemens.
Oh, yeah. And he was awesome in it, too,
man. He's fantastic. He's the best part of the movie.
Yeah, well, Charles Dutton was fantastic in it, too.
Yeah, Pete Postlethwaite.
Pete Postlethwaite was awesome. Like, it was just, it was a who's who of British actors.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get those sequences, like, you know, when it does harken back to the older movies, like when Ripley goes out and gets Bishop's corpse off the trash pile and hooks him up, you know, like, was it on board with us? And, you know, his answer, all the way. You know, like that stuff was awesome. You know?
And it gives a, like, Sigourney a chance to really get into Ripley more.
Yeah.
She really digs in it.
And I like that it's the Ripley we saw in Alien. You know, it's that more, that terrified, out of her element Ripley again. Because, I mean, Aliens, yeah, she was amazing in Aliens, no doubt. But Aliens was, you know, it was a feminista movie. That was why she got nominated for an Academy Award, because you had a female playing an action hero for the first time ever, you know? And, you know, picking up a machine gun and going Rambo and whatnot. And it was almost too far. It was almost, you know, cranking it to 11. Whereas with Alien 3, she's still that self-assured, that tough character. But she's a much more...
Although now, man, I totally want James Cameron to direct a movie about Susan B. Anthony.
I just, you know, it was great. But then we get to the but, the reason it's my bad. And that is that final bit, that final moment where Weyland-Yutani comes back into it. Mm-hmm. And one or two little things in there. Really bad CG pops up every now and again for the alien itself. Really, really bad. And it almost feels to me like it's something that was kind of, you know, we had to do it to save time because we just didn't have the time to, you know, to put it together.
Well, shit, motherfucker. The shit worked in Terminator 2, motherfucker.
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, the other bishop showing up at the end of it was just, it felt like kind of just a cop out.
Yeah.
And, the ending shot, like that whole her diving into the
lid.
Yeah, and having to, I mean, I like that they had the courage to kill her off. I like that it was supposed to be the last film. I like that, you know, like how it was handled. I just don't like the way it was shot. I just, that really drives me crazy.
What, falling back into the Jesus Christ pose?
Yeah, you know, and embracing the queen alien as she falls into the, and of course, if Ripley's got what's that?
She holds it like a newborn baby, doesn't
she? Yeah. It was just, you know, it was a little too much. It was a little too heavy-handed. And it was, other than that, you know, like I said, 99% of it I loved. 99% of it I thought was great. But you can tell that it was a combination of other ideas. You know, you can tell
it was
an amalgamation of different ideas that never really, were put together into a cohesive whole before it could be filmed, you know?
Yeah.
It had elements of the wooden monastery. It had elements of the prison planet. It had elements of the old Walter Hill script. You know, like it was just kind of a hash.
Did you guys ever read the Gibson script?
Yep.
That would have been awesome too.
The Gibson script was great, other than the whole alien that could infect people with spores.
Oh yeah, no, that sucked.
That was kind of lame. Just having Hicks as the main character was a pretty brave move.
Yeah.
You know, that was pretty awesome. Hicks and Newt as your central characters, Ripley not even present in the movie at all, because at the time when it was being written, Fox basically told Gibson he couldn't use Ripley because they didn't know Sigourney was going to be back.
Mm.
You know?
You know, he's picturing a poster, he keeps this for Close Encounters.
Yeah. But it was, you know, like it was a movie that works more often than it doesn't. I don't think there's ever really a moment in Alien 3 where it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, that in spite of the issues they had, in spite of the production and script issues, what Fincher ended up making was a damn fine film.
Yeah.
You know,
but it's another one where, you know, compared to this top tier work, you can see easily that it's a lesser work.
Yeah. You did, and like you can see the interference in there. You can see
that
he didn't get his own way when he was making that movie, you know?
Hence why he's the only director that doesn't show up on the extensive special features.
Oh, he has no interest whatsoever in going
to
Alien 3. And that in and of itself will tell you what kind of an experience he had making it, you know?
I'm kind of surprised he didn't decide to go with the... What's the fake director's name again?
Alan
Smithy.
Yeah.
All right, Ben.
Because if you went with Alan Smithy on his first movie, he wouldn't get a second movie.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, even then, 7 was, what, 3 years?
You know, yep.
It took a while to get 7 off the ground. Anyway, moving on. Now is the fine portion of our show where we discuss the ugly, which is what we would generally consider the irredeemable flaw in a director's body of work. You know, the movie that is detestable and should be reviled. and in all honesty, I think Fincher is probably one of the hardest guys we've ever done.
Yeah. Because even my choice for ugly isn't that bad.
and you know, he's a director where he's got a relatively small body of work, and everything he's done has redeeming values, you know, has redeeming qualities, except for what I consider one movie. But we'll get to that. Let's just keep this rolling in the same order. John?
Yes?
What do you got for an ugly?
I was this entire episode trying to decide on this. There's a couple movies I haven't actually seen, just I had no interest in them.
Okay.
But when I was going back through his body of work, I decided to finally listen to my mother and my sisters raving about it and checked out The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. And then I checked out after about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't find it interesting. I found it just empty. Just completely empty.
See,
it's like walking into living rooms in the mall.
Like, I was mentioning earlier that Panic Room felt like McDonald's. This even more feels like McDonald's. It's a movie that seems designed to win awards and stuff. It's like a Robert Zemeckis movie, but without the touch that Zemeckis brings to it, you know?
It's like David Fincher decided to make a Robert Zemeckis movie.
Yeah.
it's Robert Zemeckis, only dark and unpleasant.
And I was like, when
you know what would have made Back to the Future a lot better? Michael J. Fox getting raped and beat up.
but still, like, Fincher is...
If Biff won.
Fincher's going for that, like, tearing at your heartstrings kind of, you know, prestige pictures, and that doesn't fit him at all.
No, it's not his style. It really isn't. No. It's very...
And that's what got me about it. And, I mean, I'll probably give it another try.
I don't think later it's a broken movie, and you know what?
But no. I got no want to, though, right?
I also think that it's a movie that, like, as you watch it, I mean, everybody I know who's seen it or who tried to watch it always says they checked out, you know, 25 or 30 minutes in or 45 minutes in, but they never make it to the end. And like every other Fincher film, it is crucial that you watch the entire movie.
Yeah.
It isn't the kind of movie you can check out on and form a valid opinion of.
No.
And that's not a slog on you, John. That's on anybody, really. You know, like...
Do you remember the other day on Facebook when I posted Dope Smoker by Sleep? Watching Benjamin Button was like.
But I had watched the whole thing through, and it did feel super long.
It does. It really does.
I mean, it is a beautiful, like I was, it made me think of, in my head, of like Ridley Scott's Legend, you know?
Yeah.
It's great to look at, but there's nothing in there.
only if Benjamin Button had a 9-foot-tall devil in it, that would have been so fly.
I think my thing with Benjamin Button, I don't hate it. It's not my ugly. It wasn't my bad either. Like it fills this gap in between. And the thing with me and Benjamin Button, I don't like the movie. No, I don't enjoy the movie. It's not my kind of movie, but that's exactly it. It isn't my kind of movie, and it's not what I expect from Fincher. Mm-hmm. And for what it is, it's well shot, it's well written, it's well crafted. I just don't think it's particularly well directed, and I don't think it's particularly well cast. I think they cast the wrong actor and actress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that it's a little too cold for the subject matter.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean, like, to say it feels empty or emotionless, I can't agree with that either. I really think that there is a heart, and there is a soul to the movie. It's just, it's cold.
Well, can I take it back and use the music video for Cradle of Love? Imagine if David Fincher had directed Ford Fairlane.
Oh, man.
Greatest movie ever.
What about Dave?
I was going with Benjamin Button, too.
Okay.
So that's how I got in. But I will say that I don't hate it. I just got nothing for it. You know, like, I don't have a feeling. And that's a bad sign, you know?
Yeah, I hear you.
You're kind of left cold by it.
Yeah.
And man, it brings me back to our first Ridley Scott episode, the Younger Years. That was the reason I had chosen... someone to look over me as his ugly.
Yeah.
For, right? It's just, yeah, just it didn't feel like Fincher, and it didn't feel like anything.
No, except, I mean, the way that I'm seeing that Fincher got into this is he got to see a chance to work out with more special effects, and that was what he liked about doing it.
And to be close to the Cate Blanchett.
And wouldn't
want that.
And playing around with the film stock and everything. I think he was very caught up in the technique and kind of forgot about the story part.
I think it's just cold. You know, it's just and Fincher does cold. Fincher's thing is cold.
But it's not suitable for a movie.
It's not suitable for that movie at all.
It's like a romance film directed by robots.
Yeah, there you go. That pretty much sums it up perfectly.
Oh man, it's like if Jesse James was a romantic movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, mine. I'm gonna pick a movie that, you know what, I'm gonna call it straight up. I hated it.
Oh wow.
I absolutely hated it. And
just a second, everyone. All of our listeners, get your blast shields up because the venom is about to start flying. The spit and the vial that is about to come out of Steve Power.
I thought it was an absolute waste of 2 hours or so of my life. I thought it was pathetically written. I thought it was completely, like, just meandering, noisy, wasteless. Like, just, it was a waste of time and effort on my part. And I that is The Social Network.
Wow.
I don't know where the hell these good reviews came from. I think I think people liked it because Facebook is just so ingrained in popular consciousness right now. I think that's the only reason the film had any, like, hold whatsoever on the public and critics. I think it's a total bullshit lie in terms of the chain of events that led to the creation of Facebook. I mean, and that's pretty well documented, you know, that the so much of the shit just came from Aaron Sorkin's power book that it's not funny. Jesse Eisenberg is a fucking terrible actor in it. He just does awkward, unlikable douche, you know. The supporting cast are all useless. The story is non-existent. It's a bunch of fucking preening college kids spitting venom at each other for 2 hours of my time. Nope, it sucks. It's a piece of shit movie. I'm going to say it straight up. It looks pretty as hell. Reznor and Atticus Ross, you guys were nominated for an Academy Award for a bunch of tones. Okay, all right. You know, it's not really a particularly amazing score or anything.
They threw a Moog keyboard into a walk-in freezer with a bag of cats.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I don't want to diss Trent Reznor. I like you, Trent Reznor. Nine Inch Nails are the bomb, yo. But I don't know where the hype for this movie came from. I really don't.
You take the whole Facebook thing that you had mentioned a moment ago.
Yeah.
You know, Facebook is so ingrained into pop culture right now.
Yep.
You know, we are a social network.
Yep.
And I think it was just everybody after Benjamin Button, because, I mean, that was pretty critically lauded.
It was,
everyone was just in the mood to, you know, kind of just spooge all over how awesome Fincher is.
And I think that's a lot of it. I think he had Zodiac and then Benjamin Button, which were both really critically acclaimed movies. And I think it was just kind of riding on that, you know?
Yeah, when Ron Howard won his Oscar for Beautiful Mind.
Yeah.
But I mean, the whole reason he won that for Beautiful Minds is because they fucked up 2 years ago between Apollo 13.
Yeah.
Which rightfully deserved it. You know, like, it's, oh man, it's just, The Social Network just makes me angry as a movie. You know, like, it's like the Coles Notes version of the story written by a bunch of guys who work for Wired magazine for all the non-initiated plebeians in modern society who don't know one end of a computer from the other. You know, like, that's what the movie feels like to me. It's just, oh, it's such a fucking insult to anybody who knows anything about how it all came together or knows anything about the IT industry as a whole, you know, like, it's just, and then of course people sit down and they watch this movie and then they think they're fucking experts.
I was like, oh my God. I must say, I really liked, the Social Network. I really enjoyed it. For my part, I really liked the dialogue and the way it was written and falling off. You know, the rhythm was good.
Oh, Mr. But, Sorkin.
But
I'm like, another line of coke, Aaron.
But like, I know nothing about IT. I know nothing about the creation of Facebook, and I was just enjoying the story and the way that it was brought up. And like, when I finished it for the first time, like I was like, okay, I was also kind of left. I liked it, but I was like, okay, what's the big deal here?
Yes, yeah, yeah, and it's like. Okay, what's so tense or exciting or interesting about watching a bunch of college students sue each other for 2 hours?
But then,
guys, come on, listen, apple teenies.
But then, I mean, you look at how like Fincher shot it and it's edited and it's basically done in a like 4.0 or whatever environment, you know. Like the scenes flowing into one another and like all these multiple windows and all that stuff.
And see, that stuff didn't appeal to me either. You know, like it's stylish, it's fancy, but it doesn't feel organic. It doesn't feel, you know, I don't know. It just, it didn't.
And in the end, it goes back to, is this like success doesn't make you a happy person team?
Yeah.
From the game, you know?
I don't know, man. Like, I understand it was low budget, and I don't even want to diss Jesse Eisenberg, because I like Jesse Eisenberg. I really do. But I just, man, that movie. And, like, you know, the scenes, like, you know, where he's sitting down in the university, the trailer shot, you know, where he's going on talking about what he wants and blah, 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 and, you know, they don't get him. They're just like, huh, excuse me? You know, and, like all of that stuff to me was just so false. You know, like, it just felt so... Aaron Sorkin, I guess, you know, like it just so convoluted and so just constructed that like no part of the movie ever felt natural to me, you know, no part of it ever.
Yeah, it definitely feels, you know, written. It's like when I finished it, I was like, this movie was more about the script than about.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Like it was more about what words sound witty being strung together than character, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I
would agree with that.
Yeah, I really didn't like it, and I don't know why David Fincher bothered to get involved. I guess he must have had some interest in there, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you can see some of his themes and, like, his interest of seeing behind the facade of the success and all that stuff.
And maybe that's what it is, but I to me, there's no redeemable value to the movie whatsoever. I just, no, don't like it. Can't handle it.
You can't handle the truth, Steve.
I can't handle a lie.
Gabe, that was the worst Jack Nicholson ever.
You can't handle the truth.
The only imitation I can do is Arnold. You know, you guys know that.
So I guess that's it. Any more parting thoughts on our chosen uglies?
No, not on the uglies.
No.
No?
No.
Everything's left pretty clear?
Yeah.
Yep. Parting thoughts on David Fincher. Mr. Mercer?
I love you, Dave. I really do. You know, there's... I was glad to see there's a director out there that, you know, when they say shot like a music video, it doesn't always have to be Michael Bay.
No.
And it doesn't have to be a bad thing.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't have to be a negative. No. How about you, Gabe?
I mean, Fincher he's got a really strong body of work overall, and he's really an interesting guy who likes to go to places that most people don't go, and he does tension like anybody, like nobody else that I know of. And he's got a great eye, and I'm really looking forward to whatever his next movie will be, because, you know, it's going to be interesting.
Amen. I think, in terms of visual style, the guy is absolutely brilliant. I think he's one of the few, you know, that second generation, I call them, the guys who came out of the early 90s, late 80s, who followed on the heels of guys like Steven Spielberg and Lucas and Ridley Scott and, like, you know, Frankenheimer, Francis Ford Coppola, all of these guys, you know. He's one of the few who's got, like, this really strong sense of the visual that's actually genuinely new and fresh, you know. Like, you look at some of the stuff in Seven or Fight Club, some of the little shots in those movies, the way he transitions scenes. he really is like he's got a different thought process going on there. You know, there's something going on in that head of his that's not good.
And a great thing is that it never feels flashy.
No, no.
You know, it always feels
matter
organic.
How seizure-inducing it gets, it always feels organic. You know? Like the CG garbage can in Fight Club. I mean, that shot is awesome. You know, and just Edward Norton's little monologue over it, you know, Planet Starbucks, the Microsoft Galaxy, or whatever it is he's saying. You know?
The penguin, man.
Yeah, the penguin. Slide!
And then they do the scene right away later with Helena Burton, and with like the totally just nonchalant slide.
She just looks at him like, "What are you waiting for? Slide!" But like, just the way he filmed
the shot. I can't remember what she's doing in it, but he's describing. It's one of the whole Marla Singer. And she takes a cigarette down. And she's got the real, like, super slow mo shot of the smoke rolling out of her lips.
Yeah, it's like the old 1950s glamour shot. Yeah. Only completely unglamorous.
And I think that's actually the thing. Marla, that fucking tourist.
If I had a tumor, I'd name it Marla.
I'd name it Marla.
But see, it's just he is a filmmaker that like he brings so much different stuff to the table. Fight Club 7 was another prime example of that. Alien 3 with like the chase sequence like you talked about earlier. You know, it's he does a lot of really different stuff. Zodiac, I mean, who else ever saw a version of the 1960s that looked like Zodiac? Like whoever filmed that, you know?
I mean, Panic Room notwithstanding, with the game, Fincher takes, you know, the standard throwaway thriller and then just jackhammers your senses.
Yeah, it's you know, he is really like he's a
like,
very
are you sitting comfortably? I'm trying to get comfortable, Mr. Fincher. Good. <'Cause I'm> gonna...
he's not one of these directors who really draws like obscene amounts of attention to himself, but at the same time, you know, he's become a name specifically because of his distinct style. And that's you know, that's to be applauded. That's really to be commended, you know? Like that's he's in the same, you know, upper echelon of guys like Chris Nolan and, you know, like, I hesitate to say, but maybe Quentin Tarantino, you know, guys who've made a name for themselves, you know? And kudos to Fincher for that.
Yes. Go, Finch. Go.
So I guess that's it for this week's episode.
I never once called him Abercrombie and Finch. I'm proud of myself.
Oh.
Why didn't you wait till we stopped recording?
So there is
no post.
The next time we come back, there'll probably be a lot of us. Last count was, I think, we're at 25 people coming to you live from four different continents.
we're like the WrestleMania 2 of podcasts.
No, we're going to record live from four different continents with like 24 different hosts and featuring Mary Lou Retton as Tiny Tim. You know,
live, there will be live tweeting.
Yeah, we will have a live tweet. When one of us is talking, someone else will be live tweeting. John is so full of shit right now.
When am I not full of shit?
So, yeah, next time, James Cameron, it promises to be huge. You may need to carve out a Sunday afternoon to listen to that one. I guess all that's left to say.
See you next Wednesday.
See you next Wednesday.